We had been dating 11 months and 14 days when you asked the question, "Why don't you tell me you love me more?" To my mind, the inquiry had two potential meanings. One, why don't I say, "I love you more," as in why don't I favorably compare my present love to the love I felt in the past? And two, why don't I say, "I love you more," as in why do I not employ the phrase, "I love you," with more frequency? The latter seemed more likely, though I considered the former the more interesting possibility. As I parsed the semantics, you threw up your hands and directed me to go fuck myself. I declined. After 22 minutes of convincing you to unlock your bedroom door, I explained that I'd already told you I loved you approximately 6 months before. "I remember," you said. "But don't you find it odd you've never said it again? Did you not believe me the first time?" I have never been a person to say things for the sake of saying them. The son of an engineer and a linguist, I value precision and economy. To those who would say love is not the realm of such virtues, I would point to over a dozen relationships I've seen derailed by failures in communication. Not just lack of communication, but lazily constructed, reckless verbiage. Choose your words, especially to those you hold dear. A month later, I asked you to marry me, to which you said yes, to the minor dismay of your friends. A year after that, we were married in a greenhouse in Cape Cod. Small ceremony, friends and family, writing our own vows. You called me the most reliable man you had ever known. Dependable, honest, remarkably forthright. I said what I meant, never exaggerated, and it was that quality, that directness for which others would take me to task, that you found so terribly romantic. It seemed, for just a moment, you were addressing the crowd more than me, as if to say, "Here it is. Here are my reasons." I took no offense. I wondered it myself. My vows consisted of nothing more than a series of observations. Our third date. A hole-in-the-wall steakhouse you'd discovered on a shopping outing with your sister. You were wearing a burnt orange sweater over a white-collared shirt. You ran late that evening from an afternoon jog and didn't have time to straighten your hair. Thick, dark strands hung in loose waves around your flush from the cold face. You spoke excitedly about your newest project at work. There was a rhythm to your voice, an acceleration of words leading to a pause, a breathy rest, and then a more deliberate predicate bringing your point to cadence. Your shoulder slumped inward, you used your outstretched hands for emphasis, fingers splayed like an insect's antenna. When you told a bad joke or sensed your story was getting dull, you averted eye contact. When you laughed, your neck craned upward, your shoulders relaxed, and your top lip disappeared into your smile. 2 hours into our dinner, you excused yourself to the ladies' room, leaving the entire room in a gray haze. I could only focus on you. Your syncopated step, your forward lean, the way your legs seemed to disappear amidst the table as you glided across the room. You caught me looking at you and were embarrassed, apologizing again with your eyes until a waitress directed you. You returned, smiling bashfully. You laughed, though nothing had been said. You told a disturbingly detailed account about catching your grandmother making love to a handyman, then insisted on paying the check in consideration for my listening. You thought you were so boring, so unworthy of attention, when in reality you were just painfully self-conscious and easily distracted. My mother had always told me marriage was the covenant of witnessing another's life. I could observe you forever. After the wedding, we moved to New York, where I'd been offered an assistant professorship at Columbia. Through a friend of a friend, you secured a position as event coordinator at the New York Public Library. We moved into an apartment on the Upper East Side, walking distance from the park. Together, we took jogs in the morning, you deliberately slowing your pace, I deliberately quickening mine, so that we could begin and end together. Our life was a study in reason and compromise. We developed routines. One movie a week, normally at one of the independent theaters downtown. Eating out twice a week, one casual spot, the other whatever was in vogue according to New York Magazine or the Times. Theater once a month, classics for you, contemporary for me. Dinner parties twice a month, with divided cooking responsibility. You a specialist in Asian and Latin cuisines, I more inclined to American comfort food. When either of our parents visited, we offered our bed and refused to let them pay for anything. We went on tours, led them through museum exhibits, and both pretended to enjoy the opera. 3 years into our marriage, we tried conceiving a child. 3 months into our attempts, you became pregnant. A month after that, miscarriage. Through numerous doctor's visits and countless tests, you were very brave, and I admired your fortitude. We tried to conceive again 6 months later, and 2 months after that, you were pregnant again. Toward the end of your first trimester, another miscarriage. This time, you took it harder. We had been confident. We had told our parents, despite the advice of friends, to wait until trimester two. We had chosen names. A few months later, we talked about adoption, but ideas never solidified into plans. Eventually, we came to accept that our life together, our future, would be isolated to the two of us. Finally, dismissing all visions of parenthood, we came to realize the myriad beauties of accountability to only ourselves. In the years that followed, I received a tenured professorship at Columbia. You were promoted to head of event planning at the library. We moved out of our one-bedroom on the Upper East and bought a more spacious two-bedroom in Park Slope, converting the second bedroom into an office guest room. We hosted a well-attended housewarming where we served a Middle Eastern buffet and spicy rum punch. We increased the frequency of our theater going to twice a month and continued the tradition of alternating holidays to my family and yours with the occasional Thanksgiving hosted by us. Compared to most couples married for a similar duration, our marriage had few conflicts. No indiscretions, no separations, arguments certainly, some quite heated, but most small, trifling in the grand scheme, differences in personality rather than loaded betrayals. My aversion to travel, for example, stemming from my fear of airplanes, which I readily conceded as irrational given the statistical data. You, by contrast, loved to travel. In the spirit of conciliation, I didn't make a fuss when you took your annual trip with your mother. Ireland, Sweden, Thailand, Malaysia. Even though I felt disoriented without you, even for so short a time, I did not complain, and neither did you. After your mother passed, however, at the age of 77, you still wanted to see the world, and I still had the fear that a metal tube self-propelled into the sky would spell my certain doom. Nevertheless, for our 23rd anniversary, I booked 2 flights to Rome. For the first time in a long time, you seemed surprised, and kissed me in a way you hadn't in years, a way I had forgotten to miss. "Thank you," you kept saying. "You're quite welcome," I replied.